The next time you're at a restaurant, take a look at the condiments on your table. You'll probably see one of those ubiquitous pink packets with the musical note, sweet and low. The pink packet has a long, tangled, and not always sweet history. It was invented in the 1950s by Ben Eisenstadt. 50 years later, Eisenstadt's grandson, Rich Cohen, has written a book about the family's enterprise. It's called Sweet and Low. Rich Cohen joins us from our New York bureau. Hello there.
Hi.
There's more to this book than just the story of a sweetener. It's also the story of your family.
Yeah, it's the story of one guy's invention and sort of if you take a mildly dysfunctional family like mine was from Brooklyn in the 1930s, inject a couple $100 million that resulted from the fortune, and it's like a lab experiment. You watch everybody go insane.
Now, your part of the family, your mother and all of her children, have been disinherited from the Sweet and Low empire, so to speak. Is this book sort of sour grapes for you?
I don't think it's sour grapes. I sort of felt like to be disinherited is to be set free. A lot of these stories are the kind of stories you might just tell around the table when you're in the club. But if they kick you out of the club, the only place you can tell them is outside. And to me, it's sort of like the greatest story I know. It's like a dark parable of the American dream is my Grandpa Ben and his little simple invention, which was sweet and low, that's so sweet up front and has the bitter aftertaste. And that was like the story of the family. And I wanted to tell it to sort of own it and preserve it and give it to my own kids. They weren't going to get money, at least they could have some of the story.
You actually write at some point in the book about that aftertaste, that bitter aftertaste that we all know from Sweet and Low, that aftertaste is the soul of Ben. What did you mean by that?
Well, I felt like there was something about my grandfather and his life that was bitterness wrapped up in sweetness. And it was one of these strange things where the problem of the product was like a naturally occurring literary symbol in the story. It's what I love about writing nonfiction is the stuff that's true is always so much more real, you know, in that here was the problem. The problem was the bitter aftertaste and they couldn't solve it. And ultimately other products came along that tried to solve it. And it was a problem of his life. In a way, it started with such a sweet invention. It ended with real bitterness and strife and the split up of a fortune and the split up of a family.
Let's back up now and talk a little bit about that invention and how your grandfather, Ben Eisenstadt, came to be in the sweet and low business.
Well, he was a counterman. He was actually a lawyer. Couldn't get a job during the Depression. Went into his wife's family's business, which was diners. He ultimately had a cafeteria, a large cafeteria, across the street from the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It supported his family during the Second World War, but when the war ended, he lost all his customers. So he bought a tea bag machine because he knew how to bag tea from a childhood job, turned his cafeteria, the Cumberland Cafeteria, into the Cumberland Packing Company. And he started making this tea and nobody bought it. And he's sort of out of money, out of ideas, and he's sitting at Cookie's Diner in Midwood, Brooklyn with my grandma Betty. And I see it like a movie in a split screen. On one side of the screen is Betty trying to pour the sugar out of the sugar container, saying, "Why won't this pour?" And the other side is Ben saying, "What am I going to do? Why won't this pour? What am I going to do? Packet sugar." And he invented the first sugar packet. He did that for about 10 years. He also packed soy sauce, duck sauce, sea monkeys.
And sea monkeys.
Yeah, you know, it's sea monkeys you order from the back of comic books.
Yeah.
Little brine shrimp. Kids get suckered by buying them. I was one of those. And he was a guy who, he was always on a diet. And he used to take the little saccharin pills that they had before Sweet and Low, and he'd crumble them up and spread them on his grapefruit. And he had this idea, working with a guy at a pharmaceutical company, of making fake sugar, which, believe it or not, did not exist. And they were trying to replicate the mouthfeel of sugar. And they made all these cups of coffee, and they put all the different formulas in it till they came up with Sweet and Low. And he thought it would be for diabetics and people who were morbidly obese. It would be sold as a medicine. And it turned out that like half of America was on a diet. And he plugged into this huge health craze and it went from a little packing company into a giant, weird American fortune very quickly until by the 1970s it controlled almost the entire market.
Now, during that time, your Uncle Marvin is very involved in running the company, but your grandfather Ben is still there, right?
Yeah, it was a classic patriarchal three-generation American fortune where my Uncle Marvin, who we used to call Uncle Marvelous, was into his 60s. He was still sort of taking orders from his father, and his father was still running the company. And in a way, it's like the thing that they always say about why families don't hang on to fortunes. The same thing that made the guy such a great entrepreneur ultimately causes him to hold on too tight and to sort of stymie the later generations, and the fortune is lost.
To this day, Sweetenlow is still the number three sweetener, right?
Right. It was number one, then it was number two, and now it's number three, and it's shrinking because Splenda, the slogan is tastes like sugar because it's made from sugar, is dominating the market because Splenda has no aftertaste.
Now, there's this point in your book where you do the taste test.
Right.
You sit down with your three packets, your pink packet, your blue packet, and your yellow packet. Can you read for us?
Yeah. It's important to know. I always see like the sugar bowls, those kind of packets as like armies on a field of battle now, blue, yellow, and red. So I thought I better get down and actually see what they tasted like by themselves to know what I was talking about. At the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver, Colorado, where I was staying after several days of altitude sickness and vomiting in a nearby mountain town, I conducted a taste test, laying packets of Sweet and Low and Equal and Splenda on a cloth-covered table in the cocktail lounge as a three-piece band played Everything Happens to Me. I opened the packets one at a time, carefully pouring the contents of each onto my tongue, swirling and tasting the sweeteners as if they were tumblers of scotch, then jotting down some notes. That notebook is before me now. Sweet and Low. Wow, that mother kicks. Like the balloon payment that comes at the end of the financing plan. Was that Camaro really worth it? Not bad in coffee or cereal, but all alone it's a mother. Equal. Not as sweet, which, if you ask me, is a good thing. No kick in the ass going away. No wonder they beat the pants off Uncle Marvelous. Splenda. The yellow pack makes me think of dog pee in the snow. Does it taste like sugar? Not quite. Something is chemical and off. Maybe it's been so long I forgot what real sugar tastes like. I'm all hopped up. Sugar isn't sweet enough for me. I'm a Diet Coke fiend. Maybe I'm projecting all the lab work onto the product. But it's close. No aftertaste. Smooth. Cumberland is going to get crushed.
Now, your mother, Ellen, was one of four Eisenstadt children, but she was never really a part of the Sweet and Low empire. Why is that?
Well, because she got married and moved away. My father was transferred to Illinois, where I grew up and had her own life.
And then there's your Aunt Gladys.
Mm-hmm. My Aunt Gladys did not leave her room from the Nixon administration until shortly after the attacks of September 11th, when Betty died. Grandma Betty died. Her mother died. She took to her bed for various reasons sometime in the mid-70s and pretty much stayed in her room her entire adult life. And she came out of her room to attend the funeral of my Grandma Betty, her second parent. I always felt in some way that she's the key to the whole story, that there was a sort of a Citizen Kane-like quality to the story, and that Aunt Gladys was the key to unlocking it. And Aunt Gladys, in some way, was guarding her parents. She was guarding access to her parents' love. And in some way, all the kids were fighting for the blessing of the parents, and Gladys was like in the desert sitting next to the well, and the well contained the love of the parents. She, at the end of my grandma's life, it was my grandmother and Gladys alone in their house, still in the same house where my mother grew up in Flatbush, with Gladys taking care of Betty and actually drawing a salary for taking care of her. And it was in this moment that the will was changed, not by my grandpa Ben, but my grandma Betty, while she was in the house being cared for by her daughter, Gladys, the will was changed and the sentence was added to Ellen, my mother, and her issue, me, my brother, and sister, I leave nothing for reasons I deem sufficient.
What do you think your grandmother Betty meant when she said reasons I deem sufficient?
I don't know. It's like the mystery of the book that I'm trying to puzzle out. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons given. One is that my mother suggested a doctor to operate on my grandfather who needed heart surgery. He ultimately died after that surgery, and my mother was blamed for that. But that's so crazy that I felt there were a lot of things. I felt my mother and my grandfather, Ben, had a very close relationship. And this actually threatened my grandma Betty, and felt that if Ben loved his daughter too much, he couldn't love her. I mean, I felt it was really intense, and it was Brooklyn, and it was this hothouse world. But the thing that makes it so amazing, of course, is its connection to the product. And the fact that it's all sort of like, I like to imagine it, you tear open a Sweet and Low packet and pour it out, and all these people pour out into your coffee. That's what you should know when you're using it next time. Going around and talking about the book, I find that this is a lot. This happens to a lot of people. I mean, these family fortunes rip apart families. And basically, you get generations of people that don't work, and generations of people that try to protect their money, and other generations of people that have been kicked out. And they're all fighting for the same legacy. It goes back to the Bible, really. But to me, when I started really working on this book, and you sit in a diner, and you look around, and you see the sugar packets, you see the ketchup bottles, you see the mayonnaise container, you're looking at a series of struggles and battles for money, for legacy, and for wills. That's what I think now. It's basically how the country was built, and it's the stories that don't get told.
Rich Cohen is the author of Sweet and Low. He joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
To find out more about Sweet and Low and read an excerpt from the book, go to our website, npr.org.